Genesis chapter 1, verses 11 through 13, and God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth." And it was so. The earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the third day. The fool has said in his heart, "There is no God." Today we're going to look at plants. Every area of our world gives, I believe, overwhelming, irrefutable evidence of a creator. Take any section or part of this world or of this universe and study it. The more that you study it, the more obvious it becomes. This world could not have come about by chance. Look through a telescope. Look through a microscope. Look through with just the naked eye. The evidence is staggering. The theory of evolution is a lie, and I believe it can be proved to be a lie to any unbiased, open-minded seeker. Psalm 104:24 says, "O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy riches." This verse accurately describes the plant world. Once again, as in our previous topic, there's incredible diversity and design and splendor in the area of plants. We take them for granted and don't think much about them, but every plant, when studied, is astounding. They tell us that one plant of rye has about 4 million roots, which, if stretched end to end, would cover 300 miles. There are some 500 different kinds of plants which eat meat. Insects, not In-N-Out burgers. By the way, for those of you that are vegetarians, there are even plants that eat meat. Consider that. Most everybody is familiar with the Venus flytrap, but there are some 500 different insect-eating plants. We'll talk a little bit more about them a little later on. It is estimated that the spruce has from 10 to 14 billion cells, each of which is like a miniature factory, performing whatever function is necessary for the tree, and also manufacturing cellulose and lignin, which make up its cell walls. The tree is constantly producing additional living cells, and each one of these cells has a specific function. Some of the cells, when they subdivide, move to the tree's outer edge and form bark tissue, and others move toward the inside and form woody tissue. Each cell stems from the same initial cell, and yet somehow they know exactly where to go. It's not a one-on-one ratio either. The tree needs far more inside cells than it does the bark cells, and yet they always subdivide correctly and go to the right place. And scientists can only tell us what happens. They cannot tell us the how or the why. What about trees that grow on the sides of mountains? How do they grow vertically instead of at right angles to the terrain or in a perpendicular fashion? A tree grows on the side of a mountain or is abnormally bent from strong prevailing winds, then unnatural cells called reaction wood are produced within the tree. These cells help push the trunk into a vertical alignment and keep the center of gravity in a relatively stable position. This special reaction wood has a very high lignin content, which increases the compressive strength of the lower side of the tree, literally pushing the tree into a more vertical position. How could this specialization evolve? Trees on the mountainside that didn't have it would be far more likely to fall over and not survive. And yet, not all trees need it. Most don't. How was it ever produced? The evolutionist doesn't know. Consider the infinite variety in the plant world. Some plants grow so slow, some trees it seems like they aren't even growing at all. There are some kinds of bamboo that can grow almost 3 feet a day. Turnip seeds, under good conditions, they say will increase their weight 15 times a minute. A turnip seed in rich soil can literally increase its weight 15,000 times in a day. A squash 18 days old was harnessed to a lever in its growing process, and it lifted 50 pounds on lever, 18 days old. 19 days later, it lifted 5,000 pounds. Some orchid seeds are so small that you can put over 3 million of them into a thimble and still have room left over. One tree's seeds are so big that they're over 20 inches long and bigger around than a basketball. There's a great infinite variety of all types of vegetation, a wide assortment of grasses and trees and bushes and plants and vegetables and fruits, all faithfully and consistently producing after their kind. This is so constant And the evolutionist surmisings about the development of plants so unconvincing that even evolutionists have a hard time acting as if they buy it. Dr. Patterson, an evolutionist, said he had seen a lot published on the origin of plants. And in reference to those materials, those evolutionary books, he said, "I would agree that they are not convincing." And that's from the mouth of an evolutionist. Dr. E.J. Corner of the Cambridge University Botany School said this: "Much evidence can be adduced in favor of the theory of evolution from biology and biogeography and paleontology. But I still think that to the unprejudiced, the fossil record of plants is in favor of special creation." Once again, this area, as in the other areas we have dealt with, there is an absolute lack of transitional fossils. This is a serious problem for the theory of evolution. And if you're a person who believes in evolution this morning, this is a serious problem for you. The very foundation for your belief is missing. You are not missing a key piece of evidence. You are missing your evidence. The evolutionary scientist does everything he can to keep that fact from you. Mr. Fix, himself an evolutionist, had this to say about fellow evolutionists: "So when it comes to the fossil record or any other body of evidence, for the sake of the good cause, they accentuate the support of data and ignore or minimize as far as possible the contrary indications." This is science. This is from the mouth of an evolutionist. And yet the evolutionist claims to be scientific. Science is the pursuit of knowledge and the study of documented data and facts and testable theories. And yet they say they try to suppress or ignore anything that would go against their theory of evolution. Dr. Raup, an evolutionist, said this: "During the Cretaceous period, there were 65 to 75 million years with virtually no insect fossils. When asked to explain this, he said it was just bad luck." Dr. Eldridge, an evolutionist, said that the categories of families could not be connected, no transitional fossils. And Dr. Raup said that a dozen or so large groups could not be connected with each other. Dr. Patterson wrote a book titled simply Evolution for the British Museum of Natural History. A letter was written to Dr. Patterson asking why he did not include a single photograph of a transitional fossil in his book. I quote from his response to that letter: "I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. You suggest that an artist should be used to visualize such transformations, but where would he get the information from? I could not honestly provide it, and if I were to leave it to artistic license, would that not mislead the reader?" An evolutionist is honest. He goes on to say, referring to another evolutionist, a man by the name of Dr. Gold. Dr. Gold and the American Museum people say there are no transitional fossils. "You say I should at least show a photo of the fossil from which each type of organism was derived. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. Not one such fossil." Dr. Patterson in an interview said this: "If you ask, what is the evidence for continuity? You would have to say there isn't any in the fossils of animals and man. The connection between them is in the mind." That's from an evolutionist. Dr. Patterson went on to say that evolution was based on faith alone. Dr. Kitcher, another evolutionist, tried to cover for Dr. Patterson's letter. He said Dr. Patterson, when he wrote that letter, he wrote in complete ignorance. He thought that he was writing to a letter to a fellow professional scientist. In other words, if he had known he had been writing to a layman, he would not have been so candid and open and honest about it. How do evolutionists account for the total lack of transitional fossils? I mean, there are no transitional fossils. The theory of evolution is based upon transitions from a lower species to a higher species, to a more advanced state continually. And yet there are no transitional fossils, no links between the different species. None. It's not like we're missing a few key ones. There are none. No transitional fossils. How do they account for that? Listen to this. This is from National Wildlife Magazine, which is an evolution publication, if you read it. filled with evolution, for reasons about which scientists can only speculate. Some of these fishes applied their lungs and lobed fins to new tasks, the lungs to breathing air, the fins to walking on land. As generations passed, the creatures became increasingly adapted to terrestrial life. They gave rise, eventually, to the amphibians, true land animals with fully developed legs, and led ultimately to reptiles and dinosaurs, birds, and us. The earliest stages of the trek up the shore apparently took place in habitats poorly suited to the preservation of fossils, so scientists can only guess as to how the transition actually happened. Well, amazing. We have no transitional fossils because these early ancestors had the misfortune of dying in places that were poorly suited to the preservation of fossils. And yet that is their scientific explanation as to why we have none. No transitional fossils. You know, literally there are trillions of fossils that have been found. Trillions. Trillions. If just 0.01% were transitional fossils, we'd have an unbelievable number of transitional fossils, and yet we have none. How about the total lack of transitional life forms in existence today? Why isn't evolution taking place today? And how do they account for that? Although the life histories and adaptations of today's amphibious fishes give us a sense of how vertebrates made the shift from sea to shore, it is unlikely that these creatures will give rise to future terrestrial species. Here's the reason. The main difference between amphibious fishes and the fishes which once gave rise to the amphibians and reptiles and us is that today there are animals living on dry land, says Carl Gans, a Michigan biologist. So while these fishes may get into the amphibious niche, once they go on to land, they are competing with specialists. So then, should modern amphibious fishes be written off as an evolutionary dead end? Not exactly, says Malcolm Gordon. You can hypothesize that if for some reason life on land were to cease, then there is the possibility of reinvasion. In that light, you could look at existing amphibious fishes as being an evolutionary insurance policy. So no fish will make it up on land now because they're competing with specialists, and they'll get eaten. Maybe some piranha can make it, and they can come on shore and bite everybody and evolve into something. As usual, we've digressed from our original topic, plants. Have you thought about the many benefits that plants and trees provide? Literally, we could not live without them. They play a large part in helping to beautify the world, but they also provide food for man and beast. Many kinds of them offer valuable medicines, medicinal products. Many of them provide shelter and raiment for humanity and shelter for many animals. They purify the air. They take in deadly carbonic acid gas or carbon dioxide, which is produced in great quantities in the breathing of man and animals and decaying matter and burning materials. Carbon dioxide is produced in great quantities. By a chemical process, the carbon dioxide is used for the plant's own needs, and then life-giving oxygen is released. No small miracle. All the machinery necessary for the imprisoning of the carbon dioxide and the releasing of oxygen, which purifies and regenerates the atmosphere, is compressed between the very thin leaf walls of plants. An amazing machine. There's another thing that plants and trees do. They convey the moisture of the earth into the atmosphere. If all the trees were cut down, the world would soon become a desert. I'm not an environmentalist nut, just so you know. The world's total forested area today is about 4 billion hectares, which is exactly the same as it was in 1950, so we're not really losing the forest that we're told we're losing. A hectare is about 2.5 acres, so in all we have about 10 billion forested acres in the world today. So there's no real danger of that happening, but if it did, our world would quickly become a desert. Trees, the roots of trees are constantly bringing up water from beneath the surface of the ground and discharging it into the atmosphere through their leaves. It is said that a tree of average size on a warm day in summer gives off nearly 1,000 pounds of water in a day's time. And that the grass on a vacant city lot puts into the air about 1 ton of water every 24 hours, 2,000 pounds of water. Trees and plants help serve as safeguards against drought. They provide protection against floods and overflow. The roots of plants and trees give stability to riverbanks and bind together loose shifting soil. Plants' foliage decays and rots and helps to form a rich soil in which other plants and trees can be nourished and grow. The wood for trees is used for 1,000 different things, and we could go on and on. Consider for a few minutes the component parts that make up an average plant. We normally give them very little thought. Think about the roots. The roots must absorb water in large quantities. The water contains dissolved minerals, which are used by the plant. The roots anchor the plant to the ground, some going down 50 feet or more. They measured the roots of a 2-year-old clump of prairie grass and added together the roots of that one clump of prairie grass, totaled 319 miles. That's what you wonder how they need so much money for these government grants. It took a long time to put those little roots together. 319 miles. Your tax dollars at work, and now we know that, so you can go home informed today. Roots also many times are a storehouse for food. Carrots and turnips and beets are all roots. The structure of a root shows tremendous design. It has a skin or epidermal covering in the form of a protective layer that's just one cell in thickness. Its cell walls are made of thin, soft membranes of cellulose which permit the absorption of water and dissolved mineral salts. In order to gain a greater surface for absorption, roots are equipped with long, slender projections called root hairs. They also secrete an acid which helps dissolve the minerals. Scientists counted 480 root hairs on a section of a corn rootlet only 1/100th of an inch in length. 480 root hairs. In the core of the root are conducting tubes, some transporting down from the leaves, an ironed and expertly engineered, almost microscopic plumbing system. Think about the stems. Stems form the framework of the body of the plant. In tropical forests where the shade is very dense, they are found many climbing plants which run like great cables hundreds of feet in length just to get to the sunlight. The stem must carry water or sap from the roots of a plant to its topmost branches. Since water is heavier than air and naturally flows downward, how can it be carried 50 or 60 or 100 feet or more to the topmost branches and trees? The cell sap in the root hair is denser than the soil water. When the water seeps through the thin cell wall, it mingles with the sap and the root hair. This tiny cell chamber descends to the point where it can hold no more. The sap fluid in this cell, now mixed with the soil water, is now much thinner than the sap in the adjoining cell above. So it in turn has gone up into that cell and the cell above, etc., etc. And God has made wonderful provision for life-giving moisture to be drawn up to the topmost leaf on the topmost branch, even if a tree is 350 feet in height. What about the leaves? Leaves of a growing plant are so arranged that they have the best possible exposure to the sun. Often the stem and leaf stalks will grow in unusual forms and ways just to maximize this exposure. For sunlight is necessary for the miraculous process that we call photosynthesis to take place at all. You cut a green leaf and then examine its cut edge under a microscope. You will see little rooms of tiny chlorophyll chemists doing their work. These small grains of chlorophyll under the influence of the sun's energy will combine the water drawn up from the ground and that's drawn up from the roots and the carbon dioxide drawn in from the air through the thousands of tiny mouths on the undersides of the leaf. And the water and the carbon dioxide are brought together, and as the carbon is separated from the oxygen is released back into the atmosphere, and the carbon is used to make sugar. And then the sugar is then changed into starch, a necessary component for man and beast. Do you really think that all of this is just the result of happen chance? Do you think that all of this just somehow happened? All of that intricate design and the organization and the efficiency and the effectiveness of every plant? It just happened? Just evolved into being? Do you think so? This intricate design and order, which is repeated literally trillions of times over in this world, that came out of chaos, which came out of nothing. Can you believe that this morning? Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, for the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen. The invisible things of God from the creation of the world are clearly seen. God says if you'll just look around at creation, you can understand some of the mind and order and genius of God. If you look around at God's world, it says it's clearly seen. Oh, the atheist looks around and says, where's God? I don't see God anywhere. Now look around. The handiwork and evidence of God is everywhere. Everywhere. Being understood by the things that are made. God says we ought to understand the creatures made by God. We ought to be able to look around and see the hand of God. Even His eternal power. You ought to be able to see His power. Look around at this world, and God says you ought to be able to look at it and see the power of God. Even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Without excuse. The fool has said in his heart there is no God. And God says that fool is without excuse. Without excuse. You look around in this world today, and if you can't acknowledge and admit that it's made by a power greater than you and I, that there is a supreme being, Jehovah God, the creator of this world, if you want to blindly go on and think, oh, it came from a big bang, and God says, you're a fool. Have you ever read the Big Bang Theory? You ever examined that? That literally this world, this universe, came into being from a dot the size of a period on a sentence, on a page? That's the Big Bang Theory. Did you ever read it? That this whole world, everything you see, came into being from a little dot the size of a period? And from that you have this world and our solar system and the galaxies. From a little dot. You think that's intelligent? To believe that? That just because someone that has a doctorate that studied so long his brain is mush and he tells you that, then it must be? And you reject the word of God as being ignorant? Romans 1 says, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And we have men walking around today that, oh, they have all of the degrees and they've written textbooks and they've lectured in universities. But they've become fools. They miss the handiwork of God. You can walk out into the field, walk right outside these doors and see the handiwork of God. Walk through the woods and the forest, go out at night and look into the heavens and see the handiwork of God. Oh, it's not the Christian that's ignorant. It's the man that says there is no God. That says that man is a fool. 1 Corinthians 1:19, for it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. Oh, you're going to be, if you want to be saved this morning, you want to know God personally, you'll not find Him in the state university. You'll not find Him in the philosophy class. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. 1 Corinthians 3:19, for the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. Oh, how true that must be. For a man to stand up in front of a university classroom of impressionable young students and proclaim for every one of them to hear that there is no God, that this world evolved in spite of a total lack of evidence. In fact, all proof is to the contrary. For him to stand there and declare there is no God. Oh, the wisdom of man, the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. For it is written, He taketh the wise in their own craftiness. And again, the Lord knoweth the thoughts of the wise, that they are vain. Therefore, let no man glory in men. No, not Carl Sagan, not Einstein, not any of the scientists and evolutionists who deny that God exists. You ever thought about how God ensured that the plants He designed and created would continue on and propagate? What about the blackberry that grows on the mountain, deep in the heart of the forest? No farmer is going to hike 5 miles back into the woods to plant blackberry bushes. So God uses the bear to do it. And other animals that like to eat blackberries. There's an indigestible pit around each blackberry seed, and when the bear eats them, the seeds provide him no nutrients. They can't be digested. They pass through the animal intact and are deposited in the animal's droppings, sometimes miles away from where they were eaten. The animal's droppings even help fertilize the little seedlings as they begin to grow. And plants transport seeds in the same manner. God designed the perfect world. Many seeds and fruits go airborne on their own. The ash tree has a single winged seed that enables it to travel a great distance on the wind and take root far from its parent tree. The maple has a double-winged seed that can fly long distances on just a slight breeze. The milkweed and dandelion seeds can travel for miles. The violet and the columbine open their pods by means of valves, one to each pod, from which the seeds spring forth with great force. The evening primrose has a capsule which splits along four sutures, and only a few seeds are allowed to escape at a time as the wind blows, and the seeds are scattered and distributed evenly. Many plants have seeds with little hooks on them. These hooks catch on the fur and feathers of passing animals or birds and are carried for long ways where they can eventually again take root and grow. Witch hazel seeds are shot through the air when the seed pods dry out and shrink. They can be shot as far as 30 feet in this way by the mother plant. Some seeds have long silky hairs. Others have little parachutes. Some can ride the breeze for hours and travel many miles. Some seeds grow inside tough, partly hollow shells that float. Coconuts and palm nuts and Solomon seal, as well as many other fruits, can float from one shore to another in this way. The tumbleweed simply dries up and rolls away, only to plant itself in some distant place. The red plant called the Chinese lantern inflates with air and is carried away by the wind. The poppy has small pores at the apex of the capsule. As the wind moves the long stem of the plant back and forth, the very light seeds are blown out just a few at a time. The jewelweed and touch-me-not eject their seeds with a spring-like gadget. The wild geranium uses a catapult-like device. The squirting cucumber of southern Europe builds up internal pressure throughout the growing season. Eventually, the seeds are shot out with great force. Acorns of the oak tree are carried off and buried by mice and blue jays and squirrels. Some of them are later dug up, but many aren't, and so new oak trees start to grow. I learned a poem about oak trees and acorns when I was in school. So don't worry if your deeds are small or your rewards are few. Remember that the mighty oak was once a nut like you. The message is supposed to have 3 points in a poem. And so there's the poem. I'll let you know if we ever get to the 3 points. But seriously, who but God? Who but God could design such a unique and amazing array of techniques for the propagation of plants as we have considered? And there are many, 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 many more. The pitcher plant has modified leaves, forming a structure which resembles a pitcher and collects rainwater. The plant nectar sweetens this water, making it attractive to insects. The pitcher is open at the top, and then on the inside, there are stiff hairs pointing downward. When the thirsty insect enters the plant, the hairs line the way for him and make his way down to the nectar water at the bottom of the pitcher. After drinking his fill, he finds that these same hairs are blocking his way now, preventing his escape. The insect eventually drowns, and the plant enjoys its meal. The leaves of the Venus flytrap have two halves hinged together. On the surface of the leaves are hair-like structures which act like triggers. When a worm or gnat or fly crawls over these tiny bristles, an immediate impulse is carried to the leaves, resulting in instant closure of the leaves. Their hinges enable this remarkable and quick response. We have a Venus flytrap, and they're a lot of fun. Somehow they know if a fly is still alive or not also. At least ours does. It won't close its leaves if you drop a dead fly in. A wounded fly, yes, but not a dead one. They like their meat fresh, I guess, and so they want to kill it themselves. The sundew is provided with tiny hairs on the upper surfaces of its leaves. The hairs secrete a sticky substance from glands located on their tips. This liquid looks like dew, but when the insect alights to enjoy what it thinks to be a morning dewdrop, it gets stuck fast. The hairs then bend toward the middle of the leaf, which closes and traps the insect, and that's the end of the bug. That's just three of over 500 different plants that eat bugs. How could those plants have evolved? They don't even have a brain. And yet everything is perfectly regulated, perfectly designed, perfectly carried out. How long would it have taken for them to evolve those techniques and capabilities? And then how was that passed on through their seeds to the next generation of plants? What kind of super miraculous DNA did that involve? To learn that technique in a plant and pass it along to the seeds that are scattered to the wind. And somehow that plant picks up on it and perfects it a little more and perfects it a little more. Can you honestly believe, if you're an evolutionist this morning, can you honestly believe that happened? That through thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of years, the plants perfected those techniques? And the seeds of this plant somehow carried that with it and advanced it a little better and a little better and a little better till today we have a Venus flytrap. Can you believe that? Even the evolutionist says, you know, there's not much evidence for what we claim to have happened. The evolutionist. The genius, the scholar, the man filled with the wisdom of this world. You know, I'm not very convinced. We don't have time to deal with how plants prepare for winter. That's remarkable. Or how the plants that must have bees or birds help for pollination, how they get it, how they attract it. There's a whole wonderful world of which we've only had time to scratch the surface this morning. But before we close, I want to look at one last tree. Galatians chapter 3 and verse 13 says, Christ hath redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangeth on a tree. Cursed is everyone that hangeth on a tree. There are a lot of ironies in the salvation story. That God would ever condescend to clothe Himself in human flesh. The God of the ages would condescend to become human form. And then that He would choose as His earthly trade the occupation of carpentry. He had spoken the world into existence, and now He was limited to where it might take Him a whole week to just make a small fishing boat. And yet at one point He had spoken the entire world into existence. And yet He willingly limited Himself, came down to this world and became a carpenter. That He who knew no sin would take our sin upon Himself, that we might have His righteousness. That He would, as the song says, be crucified on a tree which He created. A tree made into a cross, chances are, by a fellow craftsman, another carpenter. Oh, the irony.